The Word of Mouth Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at DOUCETSurvey.com. That's DoucetteSurvey.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at NECU.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
Word of
mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, sitting in for Virginia Prescott. It's been a rough couple of months for spaceflight. On October 28th, an unmanned rocket loaded with 5,000 pounds of supplies for the International Space Station exploded just after launch. And 3 days later, one of Virgin Galactic's suborbital planes broke up in flight, crashed in the Mojave Desert, and killed one pilot, severely injured another. These traumatic mechanical failures offer a look into why space tourism may be further away than we think. But even if they can be overcome, what about the psychological effects of reaching outer space? Sydney Brownstone is a staff writer at Fast Company's Coexist, where she wrote about the often ignored mental side of space travel. And Sydney, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, Taylor. Thank you for having me.
Of course. So, Sydney, it's worth pointing out that you're not really writing about the mental pressures on people who would, say, travel to Mars and maybe be on a spaceship for years at a time. You're looking at the side effects experienced by pilots who are flying suborbitally. That's at very high altitude. So tell us a little bit about the phenomenon that you describe, this break-off phenomenon.
Right. Well, I think it'll be helpful to contextualize the break-off phenomenon in another type of syndrome I stumbled across called the overview effect. This is a syndrome or an experience that, the CEO of Virgin Galactic, George Whitesides, is invested in. There's something called the Overview Institute. Basically, it's this idea that when you pay for space travel, anyone can go up and have this really beautiful epiphany about the fragility of the Earth and the unity of humankind. And it's supposed to be incredibly emotional and intense.
Positive way.
In a very positive way. This is one of the selling points. Some space tourism companies actually use it in their marketing materials. So I knew about this overview effect, and when I started interrogating it a little bit and going through the medical literature, I came across another kind of parallel syndrome called the break-off phenomenon. And this is something that was first reported in 1957 in a paper that interviewed 137 fighter pilots. And this is a term they came up with themselves, the break-off phenomenon. It was this feeling of when they would get up to high altitudes, of feeling dissociated or separated from the Earth. And dissociation is not a term to be taken lightly. It's a very, very, it can be a very scary feeling.
This is sort of what the out-of-body experience.
Right. And the weird thing about the break-off phenomenon, too, is that it wasn't always positive and it wasn't always negative. So 2/3 of the pilots who did describe breakoff described it as something calm and peaceful. A few felt closer to God. And then there were about 1/3 of the pilots said they freaked out, basically.
Yeah. Well, how does the breakoff effect manifest physically? I mean, we're talking psychologically about people, you know, feeling very calm or feeling closer to God. But what is happening to their bodies?
It's hard to say. A lot of people report a variety of effects. In the medical literature, I found one case of a squadron commander who was hyperventilating and basically displaying the symptoms of a panic attack or several panic attacks. He would get this tightness in his chest. He would lash out at his coworkers. And those kind of all seemed like symptoms he developed after experiencing the break-off phenomenon. But I think that the main symptom is this feeling of dissociation. You feel separated from the Earth, which if you think about it, can be a really positive thing. Oh, I feel free. I feel surreal. And then it can also feel extremely unsettling.
And what happens when this occurs? I mean, they're experiencing something, but how does that affect their ability to fly?
You know, there have been a lot of different conclusions. When we first started flying astronauts and cosmonauts, NASA and the Russian Academy of Sciences, they were very concerned about breakoff happening to astronauts and ruining missions. But some researchers concluded that it just wasn't a big deal and it didn't affect someone's ability to fly. On the other hand, we have this other term called spatial disorientation, and breakoff is kind of one symptom in a constellation of weird things that can happen to you when you're flying, and it does cause pilot error, and you know, quite a few people have died because of it.
Now, does it seem like there's a pattern of maybe who experiences breakoff?
Well, the very early researchers made a few connections, and they're a little bit hazy, but if you had a history of mental illness, if you were just having a rough time on Earth, basically you were more likely to experience the negative effects of breakoff. And one researcher I spoke to who was working on an Air Force base in the 80s and 90s, worked with pilots very closely who didn't really want to tell her about breakoff and didn't want to tell her about their feelings at first. But when they opened up, they told her that some of the traumas and stresses they experienced on Earth would become magnified in flight. For example, a pilot who recently lost his son and his wife was flying, and he heard their voices. When he heard their voices, he realized that he was spiraling into a dive. He had made a very dangerous mistake, and he was able to pull himself out of it, but this is something that rattled him. And, you know, I think a lot of people have different experiences based on, I don't know, just their personalities, their experiences, the things that occupy their minds.
I'm speaking with Fast Company's Sydney Brownstone about the influence of space travel on mental health, specifically a phenomenon referred to as the breakoff effect. Now, you mentioned in your article that this phenomenon seems to have disappeared from the literature anyway in the 70s. Was it so hard to pin down? Partially, you mentioned that pilots are skeptical to talk to psychiatrists. Is that part of the issue?
It's hard. It's hard to pin down. There's definitely something called the lie to fly culture, which is the idea that if you're a pilot or you're an astronaut, you don't want to say anything to your flight surgeon that's going to ground you and ruin your career. If you say, well, I was flying at 70,000 feet in a U-2 spy plane, and I thought I heard the voice of my dead son, you know, the flight surgeon might think that you're not able to do your job. If you go into space because of G-forces or because of the ergonomics of the ship, or, you know, just how our bodies are built, astronauts will puke. This is something that space tourists will almost certainly experience too. A lot of space tourists will throw up for certain. But astronauts didn't want to show this to their flight surgeons for a very long time, so they tried to hide the fact that they were throwing up in space. So the fact that this disappeared in the 70s could be in part due to lie-to-fly culture. You know, as the space shuttle program was ramping up, NASA didn't want to cast the idea of an astronaut as someone who is vulnerable.
Well, I suppose the difference for space tourism is that you might be paying $250,000 to throw up in space. But astronauts, you know, they do go through these rigorous physical and mental tests to be able to determine whether or not they're fit for space travel. What about civilians who may pay in the future to go on these suborbital flights? Are they going to be tested in the same ways?
It's hard to tell because there's nothing really regulating this type of activity at the moment. But I did get the opportunity to visit a space training center called NASTAR, which has trained the first Virgin Galactic and X-Corps space tourists. And what they offer is a two-day training program to acclimate a person to G-forces. These are the acceleration forces that a person will feel both vertically and horizontally as they're going to space. So no, they are not subject to the same type of rigorous, you know, psychological, physical testing as astronauts were. And it's a completely different culture, too, because now, or presumably in the next couple of years, anyone who can afford space travel can go up. A lot of the selling points for these companies are, you know, you don't need to have a specialized background. We'll take you. We're making that available to you.
Well, does that seem okay to you, given that these are people that aren't going to be behind the controls? So maybe they can experience the break-off phenomenon, but it won't be devastating because there's no chance that they'll spiral downwards and crash the plane.
Given the reporting that I've done, I do have concerns about this attitude being kind of cavalier and not communicating the fullness of the experience to these space tourists. Because if you're selling the overview effect, you're selling one kind of experience. It's going to be positive. It's going to be an epiphany. You're going to realize all these things about the Earth and your duty to protect it. It's got kind of this manifest destiny environmentalist slant to it, which you would think is positive, but without communicating the fact that you might go up there and your traumas or stresses might be magnified. I think it's important to say that there's a range of experiences a person could have, and we should be open to that and take it into account. And, you know, I'm no expert, but maybe a two-day training course isn't enough to prepare someone mentally for space. We're going to find out. That training center that I mentioned, NASTAR, is currently studying whether the course that they offer can actually decrease a person's anxiety.
It sounds to me like they're selling the idea that tourists can take a two-day course to prepare for the experience of taking acid.
That's exactly the conversation I've had with my editors. They're like, so this is like an acid trip, right? And I go, pretty much. And there's actually, you know, I interviewed a researcher who wrote a paper on, you know, that mentioned break-off, but it was about hallucinogenic experiences that don't require hallucinogenic drugs. And so much of the literature on this stuff, it uses the same language of like ritualistic hallucinogenic experiences and the ego separating from itself and becoming closer to the divine. It's very, very trippy.
Sydney, once we've got people into space, potentially in the future for very long periods of time, do you think that there are mental side effects like the break-off effect that we don't yet understand that might arise as we get further and further into our efforts to explore space?
That's actually a major concern of NASA's at the moment. You know, as we get further and further away from the Earth, let's say interstellar travel, some researchers have discussed this syndrome called Earth out of view. And it's kind of like an exaggerated version of the break-off phenomenon. You know, as the world shrinks smaller in your rear view mirror, what will happen to you? You could think of parallels here on Earth. You could think of deep sea diving or extreme isolation for long periods of time. And there are certainly people who have done that and other people who have studied it, but I don't think we'll ever know until we actually do it and find out.
Well, Sydney, thank you so much for taking time to explain this to us. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Taylor.
Sydney Brownstone is a staff writer at Fast Company's Coexist, and you can find a link to her article on the break-off effect and the mental side of space travel at wordofmouthradio.org. Can an old dog learn new tricks? When Word of Mouth continues, we'll find out how one cruise line is trying to reinvent itself for the millennial generation. First, a quick break.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. Well, we just discussed the future of space tourism, and now we move to the future of seabound tourism, the cruise industry. Royal Caribbean is investing in its future in a big way, as in nearly $1 billion, which is the price tag of its newest ship, Quantum of the Seas. Touted as the world's most technically advanced ship, this cruise liner comes outfitted with virtual balconies, robot bartenders, Blade Runner-esque elevators, and a sky gondola. While the ship's technology is impressive, Gizmodo's senior writer, Adam Clark Estes, argues that it may have gone a bit overboard. Adam Clark Estes, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
So tell me, because it's hard to understand, what is a virtual balcony?
Well, it's actually quite literal. It's supposed to look like a balcony and give you the idea that you're on the edge of a ship, but all it is a giant TV screen that's outfitted in all of the rooms on the Quantum of the Seas that are interior cabins. So, in other words, if your room doesn't have a window, Royal Caribbean is now putting a virtual window in there for you.
So it's like a big TV screen with a live feed of what's happening outside of the ship.
Yes, exactly.
Adam, paint me a picture, if you can, of this cruise ship in general. I mean, it's the third largest in the world, billed as being this very technologically advanced ship, but does it look any different? Does it feel any different when you see it from afar or when you're stepping in? Paint me a picture of the ship.
Well, without a doubt, it's an impressive ship, and I was expecting to be wowed, and I was really blown away by a lot of the features on the ship. There's a lot of marveling to be done. They've done a really beautiful job outfitting it, and the things they were able to put on a ship that goes out into the middle of the ocean are incredible. You know, there's the North Star, which is a gondola on a crane arm that extends out over the ocean while you're at sea, and they have an indoor skydiving facility. All these things were really impressive, and I think that it's certainly a big milestone in shipbuilding. All that said, the ship is so big and there's so much on it, it can be a little bit intimidating. And I was only on the ship for a short time, so I constantly felt like I was running around trying to see everything instead of getting to stop and actually do things.
Apps are central to the Quantum of the Seas experience. Tell us a little bit about the apps and I guess just the whole concept of how this is supposed to be different than your typical cruise ship experience.
Well, as I understand it, Royal Caribbean is really paving the way by coming out with this app-powered cruise experience. They want your app to kind of be like a personal concierge. They come out with a couple of different apps that you're supposed to load up on your phone ahead of time, and the apps will recognize when you get on the ship and give you an itinerary and tell you where you're supposed to have dinner and show you maps of the ship and whatnot. And this seems like a great idea until the app doesn't work, which is what happened to me. About the irony is terrible, but I woke up my first morning on the ship and loaded up the app to find out what I was supposed to do that day, and the app thought that I had already returned back to dry land and was telling me where to pick up my luggage and wishing me to have a good day.
Well, did you find that all the technology aboard made it a more efficient experience in any other respect?
That's a good question. I think that a lot of what Royal Caribbean is doing with their it's a whole new line of ships, actually. There are three of them that are going to be coming out in the next couple of years. They're really trying to change the cruise experience to make it more appealing to young people. I think that the hook is there, but they didn't really completely reel me in. A lot of places where I saw technology, it was impressive. Like the robotic bartender is without a doubt an impressive piece of technology. I just wasn't sure if I needed it or even wanted it on my vacation. You know, the question my editor posed to me at the beginning was a good one, and I kept it in my head the whole time. He asked me if all of this technology makes your trip better and more relaxing, and I think that in some respects the technology is useful, but again, my life is already pretty saturated with technology. I spend enough time looking at my phone. I don't necessarily want to go on vacation and have it be my tour guide.
I've never been on a cruise myself, I should put that out there, but I have heard that they're an interesting place where, you know, you can meet strangers. Sometimes you're getting put at tables with strangers for dinners. You might become friends with a new couple, you know, meet new people, I guess, doing some indoor skydiving. Now, do you feel like the apps and that whole side of it, did it get in the way of the sort of interactivity of a potential cruise vacation?
I was actually very excited, maybe most excited about meeting other people on the ship. And I think in part because of the technology, but also in part because of how the whole experience is designed, I didn't end up meeting anybody.
That's so
one
sad.
Part of it. No, I thought so too, because I took a cruise with my family back in the 90s, and I remember meeting people at the dinner table. You had, you know, the old fashioned cruise experience. You're at the same table in the same dining room every night, and so dinner is a great chance to kind of catch up with the other folks at your table and find out what they're doing on the boat. And I was really looking forward to that, but Royal Caribbean is clearly trying to make the cruise experience more customized and individualized.
Well, it does seem like, you know, we all understand technology can get glitchy. So what if something melts down? You know, what if the Wi-Fi stops working? Are there enough humans on board to actually fill these gaps and make this a functioning cruise experience?
Well, I think that there's certainly a contingency plan. For instance, I was able to find breakfast because I still got the kind of old-fashioned printout itinerary that cruise ships give you each morning. So I don't think that the ship is necessarily understaffed, but I think that your contact with the crew members is kind of minimalized by the technology. And if the technology breaks, then you can absolutely have a great time. Like I said, my app didn't work after just a few hours on the ship, but I was still able to find my way around, and I kind of like that. Best, like the most low-tech moments in retrospect were kind of my favorite ones on the ship.
You write in your article that the cruise industry is really playing towards millennials. They really need to get millennials involved. Do you think that they're really misunderstanding what millennials actually want?
That's a great question. I kind of pause because I'm not really sure I know what millennials are, and that's kind of the problem, isn't it?
Right.
Royal Caribbean thinks that millennials are young people who are tethered to their smartphones, who want to constantly be connected and evidently want to get on a boat to go skydiving, but I'm not sure I'm that millennial. My sister, she's a year older than me. She goes on cruises, I would say pretty frequently, at least one a year, I think. And she was really jealous that I got to go on the new Royal Caribbean ship.
Yeah.
But all that said, it's not so much that Royal Caribbean is appealing to millennials, because certainly some millennials will find this cruise ship appealing. It's that it seems like they're appealing to the wrong ones. Even someone like me, who's open and excited to going on cruises, I don't think that the ship really appeals to me in retrospect. If I had to do it all over again, I think that I would probably want to go on a more old-fashioned ship that had less technology.
Adam, you're a writer for Gizmodo, so you know you've got a you're tapped into technology. Is it just me, or does Quantum of the Seas make absolutely no sense as the name for this boat?
I think they're running out of words at this point.
Adam Clark Estes is a senior writer for Gizmodo. You can find a link to his article about Royal Caribbean's futuristic cruise, as well as some great photos and videos from his trip. That's all at wordofmouthradio.org. Adam, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
And Word of Mouth returns with a look to the future of New Hampshire-produced beverages, far beyond craft brews. Get ready for Granite State vodka and whiskey. First, the news.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. Go to a neighboring bar and you won't have much trouble finding locally made beer or wine. But what about a New Hampshire-made whiskey or vodka? As NHPR's Sean Hurley recently discovered when he visited the Tamworth Distillery, hard spirits have made their way to the Granite State.
Norman Collins was famous for tattooing sailors. He hopped trains as a kid, joined the Navy, and set up an ink shop in Honolulu, where he earned the nickname Sailor Jerry. When he died in 1973, he had no idea that one day there'd be a spiced rum with his name on it.
Here's to life outside the lines. Sailor Jerry Spiced Rum.
In 1999, Steve Grass helped turn Sailor Jerry the man into Sailor Jerry the brand.
Sailor Jerry's a huge hit.
Last year, Grass says, 1 million cases of Sailor Jerry were sold. But despite having a burgeoning hit rum on his hands, Grass sold the brand 5 years ago and turned his attention to whiskey.
How did I decide on whiskey? Oh, I think whiskey picked me.
Whiskey's surging popularity didn't hurt. U.S. brown spirit sales are up 35% over the last decade.
It's growing like wildfire. It's growing like crazy.
Before whiskey, Grass says cigarettes were his livelihood. With a $20 million budget from R.J. Reynolds, his ad agency marketed Camel Reds to young professionals. But Grass, who lives in Pennsylvania, wants to leave a less controversial legacy for his kids. So 4 years ago, he began to renovate 3 historic buildings in downtown Tamworth and built a brand new distillery that somehow fits in beside the local library.
I bought the old inn and declared I was going to build a distillery there. And rightly so, the town was, who the hell are you? And so we went through a period of, I think, 2 years of working with them on plans that everyone was happy with.
Grass picked New Hampshire for the water. You can't frack in granite, he says. But he picked Tamworth for a different reason, a Sailor Jerry kind of reason.
Good brand has to have good story, good liquid, good packaging.
As a brand maker, Grass looked for and found his good story in Tamworth. There might not be a tattoo artist with a cool nickname, but there are plenty of area legends, and there's Henry David Thoreau.
And in his journals, he mentioned going through Tamworth, so that was a point of interest to me.
Have new and memorable views of Chicora as we rounded eastward. Stop at Tamworth Village for the night, Thoreau remarked in a journal entry from July 1858. Not that we'll soon have a Henry's Finest Walden whiskey, but that Grass senses in Tamworth not only a good watering hole, but a place to harvest history. 3 whiskey brands are currently in production. Their names, a closely guarded secret.
They will be for sale only at the distillery. If we get a positive response, then we'll expand them nationally.
While Steve Grass works on the brand, his older brother David has come to town to oversee day-to-day operations.
You have to build it first. You can't say, hey, I think I want to become a distillery and then get your license and see how it goes.
The distillery is sectioned into three chambers. The main distillery to the left, a tasting room in the middle, and to the right, a botanical kitchen, where Matt Power vacuum seals strawberries and Tamworth cranberries in high-proof alcohol.
The strawberry I'm a little concerned about not preserving well. I think it'll be great today, but we'll see in a few weeks how it stores.
While Power works on infusions, Jamie Oak spends his time in the distillery itself, filling white oak barrels with various spirits and tasting what he's made.
Right now, if you tasted what we have that's only been in here for a month or two, you're going to say, geez, that's real harsh.
But over time, the white oak sugars from the barrel combine with those of the whiskey in a process Steve Grass describes as one part science, one part magic.
And it's called a spirit because you unleash the spirit of the plant, the life force within it.
While Grass is cautious about looking too far into the future, he is hoping to unleash another kind of force as well.
I want the place to pay for itself and then have a few hit brands out of it that make a lot of money. Hopefully we'll get another Sailor Jerry out of this.
Sailor Jerry, the man, never got a chance to see his life grow into legend by way of a Caribbean spiced rum. But those in Tamworth will soon get a taste of their own history. For Word of Mouth, I'm Sean Hurley.
Whiskey River, take my mind.
Stick around for more Word of Mouth. We return with a look at the Billboard chart, which is set to get its first major revamp in over 20 years. We'll find out what the changes mean for artists after a break.
Word of
Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. One Direction's hit new album, 4, managed to knock Taylor Swift from number one on the Billboard 200 this week. But all that may change tomorrow when the chart gets its first major revamp in over 20 years. Silvio Pietrolongo is VP of Charts and Data Development at Billboard, and he joins us now to tell us what's changing and what those changes mean for artists and consumers. Silvio, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
So up until now, the Billboard 200's pretty much just measuring album sales. What's going to change tomorrow?
Starting tomorrow, we're keeping the pure sales part intact, but we're also adding streaming activity of tracks from albums and also downloaded tracks as well.
And when you say track sales, you're referring to the fact that up until now, say if I bought an album, a full album on iTunes, that would count. But if I just bought a single, that sort of went nowhere.
Well, I went to our Hot 100 Songs chart, which it still will. But now, we are looking at the kind of activity that, people have been sort of gravitating towards the past few years. And it's less of an ownership and it's more of a sampling, whether it is by track sales or by streaming of titles that are tied to an album, if not the, streaming the album itself.
So we know now that today, while there might be an album that's selling better than any other, there might be a song or an album that's being listened to more than the best-selling album.
Yeah, and that's the one thing, we were never able to capture. The Billboard 200 always ranked popularity based on the initial impulse, by the pure sale of an album. Now we have the ability to see how people are engaging with that album, whether they buy it on a digital level or if their ownership mentality is now accessibility-based and it's, I want to stream this album or this song on my phone while I'm waiting for a cab or waiting for a train. We have that kind of data. And that's a different kind of measurement that we're going to be using to rank the popularity of albums a bit different, beyond just the sales.
So you talk about streaming services, but we know that that's a pretty complex landscape. So what are you pulling from? Obviously, Spotify, Pandora, and how many plays equals an album?
Well, we're only pulling from on-demand audio subscription sites. So, Pandora is a radio service that we don't get from there, but it's Slacker, Spotify, Audio, Beats Music, those kind of services where you can, choose exactly what you want to listen to. And as far as the formula, it's 1,500 streams of any track from an album equates to an album sale. And on the download side, it's 10 purchased download tracks equals the equivalent of one album sale.
So 1,500 streams equals one album. Where did you pull those numbers from?
So it's based on a revenue model. It's not directly, you know, tied, because each service and each play, depending on where you play it on a service, is different. But it's, you know, it's a rough equivalent of what an album sale would equal in terms of revenue generated.
So how do you expect these changes will pan out for top artists? Do you expect to see, you know, some of the people in the top 10 or at least the top 50 moving around in their places?
Yeah, we do see, you know, some changes. It's not the most, you know, jarring change, certainly not, you know, what happened, you know, over 20 years ago when we introduced, you know, Nielsen SoundScan and point of sales data. But you do see hit-driven albums stay within the top 10 or top 20 longer. You know, the one thing that happens now is people buy an album because they love an artist like Ariana Grande and they want to get it the first week. You know, yet that album spawns 2, 3, 4 hit singles that are generating other track sales and other streaming activity. And, you know, that's never been equated to the popularity of an album. But, you know, now you do see that, and now you'll see that album stay maybe in the top 10, top 20 more often instead of lingering in maybe the 30 and 40 just based on pure album sales.
You know, by adding the streaming services, it seems like Billboard's really acknowledging how much the music industry has changed in these past few years. But how do you keep up with the internet? It seems like right now Spotify is huge, but who knows where people are going to be streaming music from in a couple of years. Do you see that you're going to have to keep updating this on a more regular basis now?
Well, we've been doing that for the longest time. I mean, we've been, you know, tracking charts for 7 decades, and, you know, Billboard's always been quick to acknowledge, you know, new forms of music consumption, whether it was, you know, 8-track tapes or when we added digital download sales to our charts in the 2000s. You know, we added streaming to the Hot 100. We expanded streaming on the Hot 100 over the past 2 years, including services like Spotify and even including YouTube last year. So, you know, we try our best to stay at the forefront of music consumption and going where the consumers are going to listen to music.
I think of the Billboard 200 as being a reflection of popularity rather than the other way around. But I'm wondering, do artists who might see their ranking move up or down suddenly have a lot at stake? I mean, do rankings on the Billboard 200 ever impact sales?
Well, it's both. I mean, obviously the sales impact the rankings, but, you know, the successful ranking impacts future sales. So it does help. And we'll see artists, like I mentioned earlier, like Ariana Grande, who are very popular and have, you know, a ton of radio hits, stay atop the chart. But it'll also help a newer album, somebody like Hozier, who has a pretty big song called Take Me to Church. So people are curious about him through that song. And we're seeing, you know, a lot of Spotify streams for this artist. Take me to church, I worship like a dog at the shrine of your life. I'll tell you my sins and you can sharpen your knife. Offer me that deathless death, the good God, let me give you my life. Take me to church. So he would have been in the top 10 on one of our test charts over the past 2 weeks instead of in the teens or 20s. So, you know, it will help new artists. It will help established artists as well. And even those artists that don't get a lot of streaming or track sales, somebody like Bette Midler, instead of opening at number 3, she would open at number 6. You know, that's obviously 3 important positions, you know, for an artist or a label, but it's not like that artist would have been number 35 instead of 3.
Well, Silvio, thanks for joining me, and I'm looking forward to seeing the updated chart tomorrow.
Thank you very much.
Silvio Pietrolongo is VP of Charts and Data Development at Billboard. You can read more about the changes being made to the Billboard 200 at wordofmouthradio.org. The new Billboard 200 may get you an in-depth look at what music people are listening to, but to find out how music gets made, you've got to check out the podcast Song Exploder. Each episode takes a piece of music and interviews the songwriters or composers to break it down into its separate parts, the process in which it was created, and the influences that helped shape the piece. Song Exploder is produced by Hrishikesh Hirway, and it's one of my favorite podcasts out there right now. Here's episode number 16, featuring the band Spoon. I don't
got time for holy rollers. Hi, this is Jim Eno. I play drums in Spoon. So there's Britt Daniel, who is the songwriter, guitar player, and lead vocalist. There is Rob Pope, who is the bass player. Eric Harvey, who plays keys, guitar, Alex Fischel, who plays keys, guitars, and a lot of other things. We're talking about Inside Out off of our latest record, They Want My Soul. This is the first way I heard it. You know, the thing that I really love about this demo is that intro. It's not on the record. It's in 5.
Time's gone inside out. Time gets to start it with. There's intense gravity. Don't got time for holy rollers. Though let me wash my feet. And I can't be their soldier.
Britt's always trying to throw curveballs at us. So, like, sometimes I'll get something like this, and it'll be a demo, and he'll be like, hey, this is something I'm working on. And he'll like just sort of see what people do with that. He'll play a demo and he'll be like, okay, let's figure out different ways to approach this. So it would be like, okay, Elvis Costello, I don't know, Iggy Pop, what would you do? And then we'll just imagine like how a band like that would actually approach this song. It never sounds really like Iggy Pop or U2. It always sounds like Spoon, but there's just these little things that seep in. So Britt played the demo, but then he was like, hey, I have this idea. Let's approach this like Dr. Dre's 2001. There's a lot of slower tempos on that record, but a lot of really cool, hooky, simple, melodic parts. You know, I think moving it into more of a beat-oriented style was the right thing to do. So we listened to some of 2001, then we just played the song a bunch of times. I did what I thought, like a Dr. Dre drum beat would be.
Time's gone inside out. Time gets to start it with. There's intense gravity.
So then you hear the new demo. I knew we were going to sort of create a sort of like a sample kit to replace my drums. So what I did here at the studio is I was working on building up snare samples and kick samples and things that I thought sounded good together that we took to Dave Fridman's. When we started the song, he pulled those up and used some of them, used some of his to create the kick and snare that's on the record. Fine with me, even though I'm the drummer. It's all about the record and the song, you know? This song has 3 solos, 3 keyboard solos. I think that's a Spoon first, by the way. You'll hear this harpsichord thing. I worked with Alex on that little part. I think it was just his Nord harpsichord sound. But we wanted to get something that sounded like a hip-hop kind of sample thing. One of the things about like hip-hop samples is they're taking it from another place. And I feel like it's cool when sometimes they fall out of time, creating this sort of weird tension kind of thing. You know, that kind of thing. You know, I was sort of pushing Alex to not be as in time at the end of that line. The second solo at 3:22 was the more difficult one. Yeah, this is a tough one. We were looking for something simple hooky, but also had a really cool sound to it. And the problem is that all three of those are incredibly subjective to any different person. This second solo here went through a lot of iterations. Finally, we came up with something that just worked really well. If you ever listen to old Marvin Gaye stuff, there is a sound with the snare that I had never been able to figure out what it was when I started recording. And then I found this one version, a mix version of a song that basically had these bongos super dry. And what it ended up being, that sound is, it sounds really great with the snare. So what I did is, I didn't know if it was going to be used. I just wanted to try a bongo part. You'll throw down ideas and you never know if they're going to get used. And, you know, we trust Dave. And the way Dave would mix is we would be out of the room for about 8 hours. And then when we would come back in, we would listen to the song. And I remember him saying something like, boy, you know, I pulled that bongo track up and I was just like, this is never going to work. And then he's like, but then I started putting it in and he's like, I loved it. I don't know. I was really happy that he liked it because I thought it was a good idea.
You know, it's really just about keeping messing with it until you feel that emotional connection to it. My name is Dave Fridman, and I'm a producer.
We've always co-produced the records with outside producers. It's good. It allows us to get other input and things like that. We had wanted to work with him for a while. I mean, I'm a big Flaming Lips, and I love that MGMT stuff he did, and Tame Impala, the Sleater-Kinney record he did. You know, to be honest, I was a little bit nervous because I was like, what is Spoon plus like Soft Bulletin gonna even sound like? That's like a crazy thing to even imagine what it's gonna be. I don't know. I feel like this record is sort of what that is.
Well, I was excited too. I think it's great when people have that sort of frame of reference.
We tend to have the vocals pretty dry. You know, we don't like reverb. We like it right up in your face. And we were like, well, maybe on this one we can try a little bit of an effect. Or we would always give Dave, like, some leeway on things.
We'd go ahead and I would throw the kitchen sink at a song in terms of effects and stuff. Basically, I would try and set a banquet for them, and then they could come in and pick whatever they like out of it, and we'd just turn off the other things.
What he used on this was, I feel like it really draws you in, and it was a tape slap from one of his old, I think it's quarter-inch reel-to-reels that he ran the vocal through, but it has this buzz to it that I just really love. It really makes the vocal, like, very special to me.
There's intense gravity in you. There's intense gravity in you. I'm just your satellite. I'm just your satellite. Ooh, I know the time's gone inside out. And now it's only like I told ya. Oh, they may wash my feet. They do not make me complete.
Okay, so this part was something that Britt came up with. At this point, everything muted, like, into, like, digital zero. Because it'd be cool, man. Yeah, you know, you just hear something in your head, and it's like, hey, I'm feeling something at this point. Let's try to mute every instrument all at the same time. What would that sound like, you know? Then Dave does the edit, and we're like, I don't know. Maybe, nah. Let's add a couple things back in. And that's the kind of conversations that we have.
Song Exploder is produced by Hrishikesh Hirway, and it's part of the Maximum Fun Podcast Network. To hear this episode in full, as well as other episodes from the show, subscribe to Song Exploder on iTunes or at MaximumFun.org or wherever you download podcasts. Thanks for joining us today. If you like what you heard, there's much more at wordofmouthradio.org. And you can follow us, send us your feedback, or share your ideas for the program on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. And join us for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Time's gone inside out. My feet.